As Frank, Stormy, and Wolf hurried back toward the scene of the gunfight at the creek, Frank wished he had asked the man he'd knocked out who had hired him and the other three to plant that dynamite before walloping the son of a bitch. But at the time, he had figured it was more important to find out where the bomb had been hidden so he could still try to stop it from going off. As Frank approached the spot, letting his instincts guide him back to it, it occurred to him that the man might have regained consciousness and fled, in which case Frank would probably have to wait until morning to try tracking him. The fella might be waiting to ambush him, too.
Wolf, find.
Wolf took off into the darkness. Frank knew that if the saboteur was hidden somewhere, waiting to bushwhack him, Wolf would find him and spoil that plan. Frank reined in and waited for Wolf to return. He didn't have to wait long. Wolf came loping up out of the shadows a few minutes later. He then turned, ran off a few feet, and stopped, looking back over his shoulder at his trail partners.
Want me to follow you, huh?
Frank nudged Stormy's flanks with his boot heels and sent the Appaloosa forward at a walk. Frank followed Wolf a couple of hundred yards to the creek. He hadn't followed the stream all the way from the mine because of the way it twisted and looped around. Faster to cut across country. As Frank reached the creek, he saw the dark shape still leaning against the bank.
Must have hit the fella harder than I thought for him to still be out cold.
Frank's gut told him that something was wrong. Keeping the gun trained on the man, he stepped out into the shallow stream and kicked his foot.
Wake up, mister.
The man didn't budge. His head hung forward on his chest, motionless. Frank reached into his pocket and found the little tin box where he kept his matches. One-handed, he shook one loose from the box and put the wooden shaft between his teeth while he tucked the box away again. Then he took the match in his left hand again and used his thumbnail to snap it into life.
Son of a bitch.
The glare from the match revealed a huge crimson stain on the front of the man's shirt. Blood appeared to have flooded down from his throat. That could mean only one thing. Frank pouched his iron and reached forward with his right hand to grasp the man's hair. He jerked the man's head back. In the light from the match, Frank saw the gaping wound in the saboteur's throat. It looked like someone had taken a bowie knife or a similar weapon to him and nearly sliced his head clean off. Remembering what the man had said about the guards at the Crown Royal having their throats cut, Frank thought this hombre's death was pretty appropriate. He still wished it hadn't happened, though. The match burned down to Frank's fingers. He shook it out and dropped it in the creek, then lowered the dead man's head. The saboteur wouldn't be answering any questions, and Frank was sure that was exactly why he had been killed. There was no point in brooding over missed opportunities. He would come out here again in the morning and have a good look around, see if he could find anything that might lead him to the man who had hired the saboteurs. Gunther Hammersmith. That was the name uppermost in Frank's mind. At the moment, though, he had nothing even faintly resembling proof that would tie Hammersmith to what had happened tonight. In the meantime, now that he was a lawman, it went against the grain for Frank to leave a bunch of corpses littering the countryside. He mounted up and went looking for the dead men's horses, hoping they hadn't wandered off too far. Frank would take the bodies into Buckskin. Maybe someone there would recognize them. Frank never did find one of the mounts he was looking for, so one of the other horses had to carry double in the grim procession back to the settlement. It was almost midnight by the time Frank rode into Buckskin, leading the three horses with the dead men lashed face down over their backs. The saloons were still lit up and doing some business. So were the doctor's office and Claude Langley's undertaking parlor. Frank wanted to check on Garrett Claiborne and the other injured men, but he figured it would be best to drop off the corpses with Langley first. He rode around back, where a lantern was burning. Langley was hammering coffins together in the work area behind the building. He looked up as Frank came around the corner, leading the three horses with their grisly burdens.
More work, eh?
That's right. You're gonna wind up the richest man in town, Claude.
Who are these?
The man who blew up the stamp mill at the Crown Royal.
I heard about it, of course. That fellow Claiborne and several of the other men are over at the doctor's office. The men who brought them in stopped by and told me that they would be returning later with the bodies of the miners who were killed in the explosion.
Need a hand with these?
No, I can handle them. Here, let me take the reins. Roy's inside. I'll call him to help me get them off the horses.
Frank handed over the reins and turned Stormy around. He rode at an angle across the street toward the doctor's office. All the windows in the building glowed yellow with lamplight.
Stay.
Frank dismounted and looped Stormy's reins around the hitch rail. He stepped to the door and didn't bother knocking, just opened it and went inside. Frank had met Dr. William Garland briefly when the man came to Buckskin and hung out his shingle, but hadn't spent any great amount of time with the medico. Garland was young, probably no more than 30, and slightly built, with a shock of brown hair, a thin face, and intense brown eyes. When Frank came in, he was winding a bandage around the arm of a shirtless miner. The miner also had bandages around his torso. Several other men sat around the doctor's front room, all of them sporting bandages and taped-on plasters in various places. Frank didn't see Garrett Claiborne among them.
Hello, Doctor.
Marshal Morgan, I understand you were there when these men were injured?
That's right.
The way they described that explosion, I'm surprised there weren't more serious injuries and more fatalities.
Where's Garrett Claiborne? How's he doing?
He's in bed in the back room there. I've given him medication to ease his pain and help him rest.
How bad is he hurt?
Well, if you saw him, you know his left arm is broken.
Yeah, that was pretty obvious.
He has burns on the back of his neck from the explosion itself and in other places on his back because his clothes were set on fire. None of those are too bad, though. He has at least one cracked rib. I can't be certain yet if there are any other internal injuries. I'm hopeful that there's not.
What about the others who were hurt bad?
I have 4 beds for patients, and they're all full. I'm pretty sure that one of them has a fractured skull. I don't know if he'll pull through. He hasn't regained consciousness, and he may not. He's the worst of the lot, though. One of the other men has a broken leg, the other one a dislocated shoulder and a possible broken ankle. They'll be laid up for a while.
I sure appreciate what you're doing for them.
That's why I came to Buckskin, to help the sick and injured.
Can I see Claiborne?
Yes, but I don't know if he'll be awake enough to talk to you.
Frank went into the other room and stood beside the bed where Garrett Claiborne lay. A single lamp burned in here, and it was turned low. But there was enough light for Frank to see how pale and drawn the engineer's face was.
Claiborne. Garrett. Claiborne. Garrett, can you hear me?
Frank?
You're at the doctor's in Buckskin. You'll be well taken care of. Don't worry about a thing.
The mine. The stamp mill.
It's gone. But we'll rebuild it better than before.
Mr. Browning will be upset and disappointed in me.
Not hardly. This wasn't your fault, Garrett. If anybody's to blame, it's me for not taking the threat seriously enough.
Mr. Browning.
Let me worry about him. I'll ride to Virginia City and wire Conrad to let him know what happened.
Conrad?
Yeah, he's my son. You didn't know it, Garrett, but you've been working for me, too.
Well, I'll be damned.
Frank doubted that. The men who were responsible for what had happened tonight were the ones who would be damned. In fact, his bullets had already sent some of them to hell, but he wasn't finished yet. Not by a long shot.
Hold it right there!
The guard was hiding near the trees, and his tone made it clear that he had the rider approaching the Alhambra mine covered, probably with a rifle.
Oh, sorry, boss. Didn't realize it was you. Didn't know you'd ridden out earlier.
It's all right. Everything quiet around here?
Yeah. Well, I guess so. I heard some shot from the distance a while back, and then what sounded like the biggest clap of thunder I ever heard. Couldn't have been thunder, though. Sky's clear tonight. If I didn't know better, I'd say somebody was doing some nighttime blasting at one of the other mines.
Maybe that's what it was. Stay alert.
You can damn sure count on it.
When Hammersmith reached the office, he dismounted and tied his mount to a hitching post. He would unsaddle and tend to the horse later. Right now, he needed a drink. He went into the office and lit the lamp on his desk. A bottle and a glass were inside one of the drawers. Hammersmith opened the drawer, looked into it for a moment, and then lifted out the bottle, leaving the glass where it was. Sometimes a man didn't want to bother with niceties, and this was one of those occasions. He lifted the bottle to his mouth, tilted his head back, and swallowed a long, healthy slug of the whiskey. It burned all the way down his throat, a cleansing, purifying fieriness, and then kindled a warm glow in his belly. As he lowered the bottle and sank into the chair behind the desk, that warmth began to spread through his body, counteracting the chill of the blood that ran through his veins. In his life, Gunther Hammersmith had killed four men with his fists, and he had done for another with an axe handle, crushing the gent's skull with one blow. All of those deaths had occurred during fights. Maybe not fair fights, mind you, since Hammersmith knew he was bigger and stronger than most men he would ever encounter. But at least the men he'd been battling with had had a chance to strike a blow in return. Because of that, he had never lost a minute's sleep over what had happened to those men. Tonight was different. That sorry son of a bitch tonight was in too bad a shape to fight back. He'd been mauled by Morgan's wolf, or whatever it was, and the marshal had also clouted him over the head with a six-gun. Perry was hurt, and he thought that Hammersmith had come to help him. It hadn't taken him long to figure out otherwise. Then he had begged and whimpered and pleaded for his life. Hammersmith knocked back another drink of whiskey, then set the bottle on the desk and reached for a leather sheath on his belt, just behind his right hip. He pulled out the heavy, long-bladed knife and laid it on the desk next to the whiskey bottle. The blade was clean. Hammersmith had used Perry's shirt to wipe off all the blood. It glittered in the lamplight, cold and hard and deadly-looking. Tonight was the first time Hammersmith had ever killed anyone with a knife, the first time he had killed somebody in cold blood, without the heat of combat to mitigate the violence. But Perry had to die. That bastard Morgan had stuck his nose in and knew that the four men had been hired to blow up the stamp mill at the Crown Royal. But Morgan didn't know who had hired them. Hammersmith had made certain of that before he cut Perry's throat. It would have been a lot simpler if Morgan had gone ahead and killed all four of the saboteurs. The fact that he had left Perry alive told Hammersmith that Morgan intended to come back and ask the man more questions after failing to prevent the explosion. Hammersmith couldn't allow that. He had thought about bringing Perry back to the Alhambra with him, but if he had done that, some of the miners might have seen him, and as chewed up as Perry was, they would have remembered. Not only that, but Morgan had gotten a look at Perry and might go around describing him. Somebody could have recalled seeing Hammersmith helping an injured man who fit that description. Hammersmith had been careful not to meet with Perry and the other three hired gunmen where anybody could see them. There was nothing to connect him to the four men. With Perry dead, there was nobody to testify, no evidence that Hammersmith had anything in the world to do with the blast at the Crown Royal. Once Hammersmith had figured that out, there was no real question about what he had to do. Hammersmith took another drink to steady his nerves. Monroe wanted production slowed down at the other mines, by whatever means necessary. He didn't care about the details, just the results. Well, tonight's actions would bring production at the Crown Royal to a grinding halt. Without the stamp mill, they couldn't process the ore, and there was no telling how many men had been killed in the explosion. They could still ship out the raw ore, but that was a lot slower and less lucrative. Now, if something could happen to cause problems for the Lucky Lizard, too, Monroe would be happy. Or as happy as he ever got, Hammersmith amended. The man was driven, filled with a ruthless bitterness. Hammersmith wondered how much of that came from being married to a woman like Mrs. Monroe, a beautiful woman so much younger than him, who probably wasn't satisfied by him and would therefore turn elsewhere for her pleasure. To a man like Gunther Hammersmith. A smile spread across Hammersmith's rugged features. He took another long pull on the bottle, but the attack of nerves he had experienced earlier had been eased by thoughts of Jessica Monroe. She would be enough to make a man forget anything he had done in the past, even cold-blooded murder. All Hammersmith had to do was bide his time. As Frank had told Garrett Claiborne he would do, he rode to Virginia City the next day and sent a telegram to Conrad to let him know what had happened. He wired his own lawyers in Denver and San Francisco, too, to let them know that he was throwing his considerable financial resources behind the Crown Royal Mine near Buckskin, Nevada. Some minor sabotage was one thing. This attack on the mine was an act of war, as far as Frank was concerned. Hammersmith and Monroe had made this personal. Frank stayed in Virginia City for several hours, burning up the telegraph wires. When he started back to Buckskin that afternoon, he brought with him his son's assurances that new equipment for the stamp mill would be on its way to the Crown Royal as soon as Conrad could arrange to have it freighted out there. He would send some professional armed guards to beef up the mine security, too. In the meantime, Frank would see about having the mill rebuilt so that it would be ready when the new equipment arrived. Conrad had considered having the men who were all right continue to mine the raw ore, but in the end he had decided it would be better for them to devote their efforts to repairing and rebuilding the mill. Frank was torn between wanting to help out at the mine and taking care of his duties as the Marshal of Buckskin. He had promised Tip Woodford and the other citizens that he would enforce the law, and he couldn't do that if he was out at the Crown Royal all the time. He couldn't dump all the responsibility for law and order in the settlement on Catamount Jack and Clint Farnham. He would talk to Claiborne and get his advice on which of the men might be able to handle the job of temporary superintendent. It was dusk when Frank reached Buckskin. His empty belly reminded him that he hadn't eaten anything since the middle of the day, and he was tempted to stop at the cafe and let Lauren, Ginny, and Becky feed him a good supper. But he wanted to check on Claiborne and the other injured miners, so he headed for Dr. Garland's house instead. Frank reined in. He recognized the wagon parked in front of the doctor's place. It belonged to Claude Langley. As he watched, Langley and Roy, the undertaker's assistant, emerged from the house carrying a blanket-wrapped figure and placed it in the back of the wagon. Frank had ridden Goldie to Virginia City since Stormy had had the hard run the night before.
Who are you picking up, Claude?
Oh, howdy, Marshal. This is that poor fellow who had the fractured skull. Lambert, his name was. Dr. Garland said he passed away a little while ago without ever regaining consciousness.
Frank tied Goldie at the hitch rail while the wagon rattled off toward Langley's place. When Frank went inside, he found Dr. Garland at a desk in the front room writing out some notes.
I talked to Claude Langley outside.
Yes, I didn't hold out much hope that poor fellow would pull through, and unfortunately I was right. He never woke up.
How are the rest of your patients doing?
As well as can be expected. In fact, they have some visitors at the moment, if you want to go in and see for yourself.
Thanks. I'll do that.
He opened the door to the other room and stepped in to find Diana Woodford sitting in a ladder-backed chair beside Garrett Claiborne's bed, spooning soup into his mouth from a bowl she held in her other hand. Ginny Carlson was feeding one of the other patients, the miner with the broken leg, which by now Dr. Garland had enclosed in a plaster cast as he had done with Claiborne's busted arm. Frank took off his hat and nodded to the two women.
Well, hello, Marshal. Were you able to get in touch with Mr. Browning?
We exchanged several telegrams, and the upshot is, new equipment for the stamp mill will be on its way in a day or two.
Excellent. Well, by the time it gets here, we'll have the building rebuilt and waiting for it. I need to get back out to the mine tomorrow to see about starting work.
Dr. Garland said you weren't going anywhere for at least a week, Garrett. Remember, he's not sure you don't have some internal injuries.
I'm fine, confound it. This arm of mine hurts, but it's nothing I can't put up with.
You better do what the doctor says. Won't do any good for you to go back out there and collapse. There's bound to be somebody on the crew you can trust to supervise the work on the new mill.
I suppose Ernest Truman could handle the job. He's been an assistant superintendent at other mines before.
There you go. I'll ride out there tomorrow and tell him what's going on, so we can get started.
All right, now that that's settled, no more business talk until Garrett's finished this soup. It's getting cold.
Go right ahead.
Diana finished feeding the soup to Claiborne, and then he and Frank talked for several minutes about what needed to be done at the Crown Royal to get the mine operating again as soon as possible.
I agree with the idea that we should get the stamp mill rebuilt right away, but once that's done, If the new equipment hasn't arrived yet, the men can start stockpiling raw ore to be put through the pulverization and amalgamation process as soon as the mill is running.
By the way, Marshall, I find it a little odd that you never mentioned that you own a considerable interest in the Crown Royal.
I'm sorry, Marshall. That fact slipped out earlier when Miss Woodford and I were talking.
I thought you said you were going to call me Diana.
Of course. Diana, my apologies to you, too.
Don't worry about it where I'm concerned. My connection with the mine isn't a big secret or anything like that. Just happen to have an interest in the Brown and Mining Syndicate.
That makes you and my father competitors.
Not really. I reckon there's enough silver in these hills to go around.
Not everyone feels that way. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had all that trouble at the mine. Someone's trying to put us out of business, Frank.
That's what it looks like. I've got an idea who it is, too.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Conrad's sending a passel of men to serve as guards. Once they get here, whoever was responsible for the blast will have a hard time getting up to any more mischief.
Well, what about the things they've already done? What about the men who died?
There'll be a day of reckoning. You can count on that.
Claude Langley had propped up the corpses of the four saboteurs in their coffins out in front of the undertaking parlor so that the citizens of Buckskin could come by and take a look at them. That was an accepted, if grisly, practice in frontier towns. Frank had never much cared for the custom, but in this case, he put the word out that if anybody recognized the dead men, he wanted to know about it. He still hoped to find something that would tie the men to Hamish Monroe, Gunther Hammersmith, or both. But while a few people recalled seeing the men drinking in some of the saloons, nobody really knew them or had witnessed them talking to Hammersmith or Monroe. No one who would admit it anyway. Frank went up to the hotel to see Monroe. He wasn't sure what he would say to the mining magnate, but he wanted Monroe to know that he wouldn't rest until he got to the bottom of the explosion that had destroyed the stamp mill at the Crown Royal. Monroe's secretary, Nathan Evers, opened the door of the suite to Frank's knock.
Hello, Marshal. What can I do for you?
I want to talk to your boss. Is he here?
As a matter of fact, he's not. He and Mrs. Monroe have taken a drive out to the Alhambra. Mrs. Monroe hadn't seen the mine yet, and she wanted to.
All right. Say, you haven't gone by Langley's undertaking parlor and had a look at the bodies of those four men who blew up the Crown Royal stamp mill, have you?
Good Lord, no. Why would I want to do a thing like that?
I've been asking people around town to see if they recognize any of those men.
Well, I can tell you the answer to that without looking at them. I never saw them before. I wouldn't associate with ruffians like that. Why would I have any reason to?
I don't know. You tell me.
You think Mr. Monroe had something to do with that explosion?
He's competing with the folks who own the Crown Royal.
Well, so is Mr. Woodford. I don't hear you accusing him of engaging in criminal acts.
That's because I know Tip Woodford. I don't know Monroe all that well yet, but he has a reputation as a ruthless man.
I think this conversation is over, Marshal, unless you have some other official business with me.
Nope. Nope. No official business. I was just talking, that's all.
Yes, of course.
Frank smiled to himself. He didn't know if Evers would report the details of this conversation to Monroe, but it seemed likely that he would. That would be just fine with Frank. He wanted Monroe to know he was suspicious. If Monroe was behind what had happened and viewed Frank as a threat, he might get rattled enough to do something foolish, like coming after Frank next time. In fact, Frank decided he didn't want to count on Evers to do the job for him. After going by the marshal's office to let Catamount Jack know that he would be gone for a while, he went to the livery stable, saddled up Stormy, and headed for the Alhambra mine with Wolf trotting along beside him. Gunther Hammersmith was surprised to hear the clatter of wheels outside his office at the mine. He stood up and went to the door, which stood open to let in some breeze along with the sound of the donkey engine that pulled the ore carts up the shaft and out of the mine. The miners were bringing out more ore all the time, and it looked like reopening the Alhambra was going to turn out to be a lucrative proposition. One of the last things Hammersmith expected to see rolling up to the office was that damned blue stagecoach of Monroe's, but that's what rocked to a halt in front of the building, with the usual driver and bodyguard on the box. The men climbed down, and the guard opened the door. Hamish Monroe climbed out, followed by his wife. Monroe took his wife's arm and brought her to the foot of the steps that led up to the office.
Good morning, Gunther.
Morning, sir. Ma'am.
My wife wanted to see the mine, and I'd like to look over the assay reports. I assume they're in the office?
Yes, sir, of course. And they're up to date, too.
Fine. I'll take a look at them while you show Mrs. Monroe around. All right?
Yes, sir. I'd be just fine. The reports are on my desk.
I'll find them.
Hammersmith reached back inside the door to snag an old slouch hat from a nail driven into the wall. He put it on as he waited for Monroe to go into the office. Then he went down the steps to join Mrs. Monroe. He didn't offer to take her arm. That would have been too forward, he thought, especially out here in the open like that. With the stagecoach driver and the guard lounging near the coach as they rolled Quirly's.
Do you mind walking, ma'am?
Not at all. It's a beautiful day.
Hammersmith led her over to the shaft, pointing out the stamp mill, the barracks for the miners, and the storage buildings as he did so.
It looks like you have everything you need here.
Well, we have to bring supplies out from town, of course, but other than that, we're pretty self-sufficient.
Are you sure it's safe to go in there?
There are a couple of dozen men down there right now, working. They wouldn't be there if they didn't think it was safe.
Following the rails that the ore carts used, Hammersmith and Jessica walked down the steps that had been cut into the steeply inclined plane of the entrance shaft. That gave Hammersmith an excuse to take her arm. He had to steady her so she wouldn't fall. It was just coincidence that his elbow nudged the warm softness of her breast as he linked his arm with hers. Their way was lit by oil lanterns hung on the walls of the shaft at regular intervals. Many of the sturdy shoring timbers on the sides and ceilings of the shaft were new. Hammersmith pointed them out to Jessica.
See? Nothing to worry about.
Not for you, perhaps, Mr. Hammersmith. But I've never been underground before.
What? You're married to Mr. Monroe and you've never seen one of his mines before?
I was just never interested in them. Until now.
Well, I won't let anything happen to you. You can count on that. I'd sacrifice my own life to keep you safe, ma'am.
Why, Mr. Hammersmith, how gallant of you.
They descended several hundred feet to the main drift, the tunnel that followed the vein of silver through the mountain. Hammersmith knew that it stretched for more than a mile under the earth. Several crosscut tunnels intersected it. The crosscuts provided ventilation and access to smaller drifts that paralleled the main tunnel. There were also some vertical shafts leading to lower levels that Hammersmith pointed out to Mrs. Monroe.
You mean the mine goes even lower?
That's right. Some mines where I've worked go down several thousand feet.
I can't imagine such a thing. We're already so deep, it's frightening.
Oh, nothing to be scared of. As long as you take the right precautions, mines like this are perfectly safe.
But things sometimes go wrong, don't they? There are cave-ins and things like that.
Yeah, most problems are caused by carelessness. I don't allow mine men to get careless. They know they'll be in for trouble if they do.
From a cave-in, you mean?
For me, I reckon most of them would rather have to deal with a cave-in than face me when I'm mad at them.
You are a rugged man, Mr. Hammersmith.
You can call me Gunther if you want.
All right. Gunther.
There was quite a bit of activity underground. Steam-powered drills, known as widowmakers, chattered as they gouged holes in the rock so the dynamite could be planted in them. In some mines, the rock was balanced so precariously that a loud noise could set off a cave-in, meaning that the hard, dangerous work of shoring up had to be completed before the real job of taking the ore out could begin. In the Alhambra, that had already been done. An earthquake or a badly placed blast might bring the place down. But short of those things, it was safe down here, as Hammersmith had explained to Mrs. Monroe. He didn't try to take Jessica all through the place. That would have taken too long and exhausted her. He settled for showing her the general layout and letting her watch some of the men at work for a few minutes.
My goodness, if you dig down far enough, do you reach Hades itself?
I wouldn't be surprised. That's probably how folks got the idea that hell's somewhere under the earth. Once you get past the upper level where it's cooler, the deeper you go, the hotter it gets. It smells a little like brimstone, too.
I think I'm ready to go back out and get some fresh air.
Sure. You've seen all there really is to see anyway.
They started back up, the light from the mouth of the shaft growing brighter as they climbed. Before they reached it and stepped back out into the sunshine, Jessica stopped.
Gunther, thank you for showing me around.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Oh, you're just being polite. I'm sure you couldn't have enjoyed getting stuck with your boss's wife like this.
You've got that all wrong, ma'am. I didn't mind a bit, truly. Fact is, I really enjoyed spending the time with you.
Really? Why, that's such a nice thing to say, Mr. Hammersmith. I mean, Gunther.
Hammersmith looked down at her, realizing just how close she was standing to him. Nobody was around. All the men were down at the bottom of the shaft. And she had this look on her lovely face, like she expected him to do something. What the hell? Gunther pulled her into his arms and brought his mouth down on hers in a hard, urgent kiss. A mine was a noisy place, and one that stunk a mite, too, Frank thought as he rode up. The frontier had been a lot more peaceful before all this newfangled machinery came along, starting with the railroad. Frank was old enough to remember what it had been like before. He could only imagine the changes that some of the real old-timers, like Catamount Jack, had seen in their lifetimes. Frank brought Stormy to a halt and dismounted in front of the building where the office was located. The place had been cleaned up and repaired a lot since that day he and Garrett Claiborne had stopped by here and almost gotten themselves gunned down for their trouble. At least, Hammersmith wasn't taking pot shots anymore at anybody who happened to come riding along. Hamish Monroe's private stagecoach was parked in front of the building. His guard and driver sat on the edge of the porch smoking. The guard had his rifle across his lap, and his eyes followed Frank closely.
What do you want, Marshal?
Looking for your boss. Is he inside?
Before the guard could answer, the door of the office opened, and Hamish Monroe stepped out.
What do you want, Marshal?
Hammersmith around.
I thought I heard you say you were looking for me.
Oh, I was. I just thought I'd talk to both of you together. Save a little time that way.
Hammersmith is tending to some chores I assigned to him. Anything you have to say, you can say it to me. If I deem it worthwhile of his time, I'll pass it along to him.
All right then, if that's the way you want it. Have you had any trouble out here at the mine?
What sort of trouble?
I reckon you heard about what happened at the Crown Royal a couple of nights ago.
Oh, yes, of course. A terrible accident. Sorry for the loss of life. But nothing like that has happened here.
I want you to know, I'm gonna find out who was responsible for that blast and bring them to justice.
I thought you killed the four men who set that dynamite.
I shot three of them when they threw down on me. I reckon the fourth one was killed by whoever hired him, so that he couldn't answer any questions about who was really to blame for what happened.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
I didn't say you would. All I'm saying is that I'm gonna continue to investigate until I get to the bottom of that business. When I do, whoever came up with the idea of blowing up the Crown Royal stamp mill, well, they're gonna be mighty sorry.
Why are you telling me this?
So you'll know that if anything suspicious happens around your mine, I'll look into it the same way. If you have any trouble, just let me know, and I'll see what I can do.
Oh. All right. Is that all?
Are you sure nothing's happened out here that you want to report?
I'm certain.
I reckon I'll be getting back to town then. Come on, Wolf.
Frank turned the Appaloosa and rode away. Without looking over his shoulder, he felt Monroe's eyes on him anyway, gazing after him with what had to be a mixture of hatred, anger, and puzzlement. Monroe had been ready to take offense when he thought that Frank was about to accuse him of being involved with the explosion of the Crown Royal, but Frank's sudden change of tactic had confused him. That was the idea. It was always better to keep an enemy off balance, and Frank was still convinced that Monroe was the enemy. He had put the man on notice that he was going to continue investigating that dynamite blast until he found the true culprits. Maybe that would spook Monroe into doing something rash, like trying to have him killed. Then, as he had promised Monroe, he would see to it that he and Hammersmith got what was coming to them.
Mm-hmm.
Hammersmith fully expected Jessica to pull away from him, to slap him across the face, to run screaming for her husband. He figured it would be worth losing his job to taste the sweetness of her mouth and feel the warmth of her body in his arms. She did none of those things. Instead, she returned the kiss with the same passionate intensity that Hammersmith put into it.
You wanted me to kiss you?
Of course. What girl wouldn't want to be kissed by a big, strong, handsome man like you? That's enough now. You don't want to muss me up too much, or Mr. Monroe is liable to notice. I don't want him to know that I've been up to any mischief.
Neither do I. I don't want to cause any trouble for you.
Then we'll just pretend this little incident never happened. Until we get a chance to do it again. And maybe more.
You mean it?
Gunther, honey, I never say anything I don't mean.
I guess we'd better get back to the office.
Lead the way.
Hammersmith took her the rest of the way out of the shaft, letting go of her arm as they emerged into the sunlight. As they started toward the office, he spotted a man riding away. He couldn't be sure, but he thought the man on horseback was Frank Morgan.
What the hell?
Is there a problem?
Nothing I can't handle.
When they reached the office, Hamish Monroe was waiting on the
porch.
Did
you enjoy your look around the mine, my dear?
Very much. Mr. Hammersmith was quite informative about what was going on down there, and he watched out for my safety every step of the way.
Oh, that's good. Hammersmith, I have to talk to you.
I'm really a little tired, Hamish. I'd like to go inside the office to sit down and rest for a while before we start back to town, if that's all right.
Of course, you go right on inside. The chair behind the desk isn't all that comfortable.
I'm sure it'll be
Hammersmith,
fine
wait right there. Let's walk over toward the shaft.
You want me and Billy to come with you, Miss Monroe?
No, you can stay here. I'm in no danger here at the mine.
Was that Morgan I saw riding off?
It certainly was.
What did that bastard want?
He believes that you and I are responsible for that explosion at the Crown Royal 2 nights ago.
Damn it! How could he know about...
I don't know anything about how that explosion happened, Hammersmith, and I want to keep it that way. You'd do well to remember that.
Yes, sir. If Morgan's not careful, something's liable to happen to him. Some folks don't like it when a lawman starts poking around in their affairs.
I think that's exactly what Morgan hopes will happen. He'd like to stir up a hornet's nest so that someone will come after him. The wise thing to do would be not to give the marshal what he wants. That's right.
It would.
Morgan can investigate all he wants to. He's not going to find out anything. The men who planted that dynamite at the Crown Royal are all dead, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all dead.
So, if anyone else was involved, Morgan won't be able to discover it. He's wasting his time. Doesn't it seem that way
yeah,
to you?
He's wasting his time.
Good. We can move on to other things. That terrible accident at the Crown Royal has given us a definite advantage for a while. Our only real competition now is Woodford's Lucky Lizard Mine.
Something might happen
Not
there,
too. Not an explosion, though. That would be an incredible coincidence. Some people might not believe that it was a coincidence.
What do you reckon might cause the most problems for him?
It would be very unfortunate for Woodford if he was hit with the bane of all mining men labor troubles. A miner's strike would shut down the Lucky Lizard for no telling how long.
I don't think Woodford has to worry too much about that. From what I hear, he treats the fellows who work for him pretty good.
Well, you never know. All it takes is one or two hotheads to stir things up. Miners are like sheep, Hammersmith. They're easily led, and once they get some idea in their head, it's almost impossible to get it out.
Yeah, maybe. But let me think about it, boss.
Don't think too long. Every mine I've ever been involved with has been the largest and most successful in its area. Things aren't going to be any different here.
We're well on our way. I got a feeling the Lucky Lizard's in for a run of bad luck, one way or another. Did you want to talk about the assay reports?
I looked them over. The preliminary tests indicate that with the new methods, the ore will assay out at a satisfactory amount of silver per ton. I think you should go ahead and increase production as much as possible right away.
I'll take care of it.
I've no doubt of that.
When they got back to the office, they found Jessica rested and ready for the ride back to Buckskin.
Thank you again, Mr. Hammersmith. You are an excellent host.
Always glad to oblige, ma'am. Come back and visit the Alhambra anytime you want.
I think one visit will be enough for Jessica. Come along, my dear.
Monroe helped his wife into the coach and followed her inside. The driver and the guard climbed onto the box, and a moment later, the stagecoach was rolling over the dusty trail back to the settlement, a couple of miles away.
You look tired, my dear.
I am. This visit to the mine was interesting, but I'm exhausted now.
Really? I was hoping that when we get back to the hotel...
I'm sorry, Hamish. I'm afraid all I want to do when I get back is soak in a hot tub to get this rock dust off of me. Then have a nice long nap.
The look of disappointment on his face was priceless, she thought. He was so easily manipulated. She could dictate his moods according to her whims, jerking him around like a puppet on a string. To the world, he was Hamish Monroe, as rich and powerful as a king. But to Jessica, he was just another man, powerless in the face of his need for her. He actually thought that she loved him, and as long as he believed that, he would do anything she wanted him to. She had looked over the assay reports in the office while her husband was off talking to Gunther Hammersmith. They were probably plotting something together, as men like to do. Jessica didn't care. Let them play their games. She had found out what she wanted to know. She knew how the ore assayed out, and her brain could calculate the income per ton even faster than Monroe's could. It was easy to speculate on how much the mine would be worth in the long run. It had been a productive day in other ways, too. Hammersmith had bitten hard on the hook, and now she had him on the line if she needed him. Pulling him in would be no challenge at all. When the time came, with Hammersmith's help, she could make herself a very rich woman indeed. All she had to do was wait for the right moment. Jessica became aware that Monroe was looking at her from the stagecoach's other seat. There was no suspicion in his eyes, only longing. She smiled at him. She could throw him that bone anyway. It was all he was going to get. Since keeping the corpses of the dead men on display in front of the undertaking parlor didn't seem to be doing any good, Frank told Claude Langley to go ahead and bury them. Frank and Wolf had gone over the scene of the gun battle with the men and hadn't found anything to indicate who they had been working for. Riding in the stream the way they had prevented Wolf from backtracking them. The man who had slit the throat of the surviving outlaw must have also ridden in the stream because Frank couldn't find his track either. Frank's frustration grew over the next few days as it seemed that his visit with Monroe wasn't paying any dividends either. That attempt on his life he had halfway expected didn't happen. In fact, things in Buckskin were pretty peaceful again. The rush of newcomers into town finally seemed to be slowing down. The settlement was still crowded, and there were still drunken brawls in the saloons, fights over poker games and women, and the occasional robbery. But nothing happened that Frank couldn't take care of easily with help from Catamount Jack and Clint Farnham. The new deputy seemed to be settling right in. He had made some friends, including Becky Humphreys, who seemed to have given up her interest in Garrett Claiborne now that Diana was spending so much time with the mining engineer. Frank went by Dr. Garland's place every day, and he knew that Claiborne was getting more and more restless. He was anxious to get back out to the Crown Royal and go to work, even though the new equipment for the stamp mill hadn't arrived yet. There was still rebuilding work to do, and Claiborne wanted to supervise it. The doctor's orders were firm, though. Claiborne still had some more recuperating to do. Frank was coming out of Leo Benjamin's store one morning, carrying a box of 45 cartridges he had just picked up, when he saw Tip Woodford hurrying toward him.
What's wrong, Tip?
Got some trouble out at the Lucky Lizard. The fellas are saying that I ain't treating them right.
You're talking about the men who work at the mine?
Yeah.
That's crazy. You pay them fair wages. You do everything you can to make sure the working conditions are safe. You don't expect more than an honest day's work for an honest day's wage.
Yeah, but that ain't stopped a couple of the boys from trying to get all the rest stirred up and mad at me. Tell you the truth, Frank, I ain't sure I ought to be talking to you about this, seeing as you and me are rivals, so to speak.
Diana told you what Claiborne said about me.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect her to keep something like that a secret, would you?
No, I reckon not. But listen to me, Tip. My late wife and my son were the ones who built up that business empire. I had nothing to do with it. For years, I was just a drifter, like that nickname somebody hung on me. It was only after my wife died that I inherited a stake in all those holdings, including the Browning Mining Syndicate. I don't have anything to do with the running of it, and I let my lawyers in Denver and San Francisco handle all the money. As far as I'm concerned, my only real job is being the Marshal of Buckskin.
Well, it ain't that I doubt you.
Good, because I'm not in the habit of lying.
All right. In that case, I reckon I've done the right thing by coming to you for help. Can you come out to the mine and have a talk with those fellas?
Problem is, I'm not sure how much I can do. The mine's not in my jurisdiction.
Well, that didn't stop you from going after the sons of bitches who blew up the Crown Royal. And remember, there's that old offshoot tunnel that runs all the way down here under the office. Since that's in town, I reckon you could say that, by extension, the rest of the mine is too.
That's a little bit of a stretch, but I can't argue with that reasoning. Anyway, my job is to keep the peace here in town. And if there's unrest at your mine, it could spill over down here any time.
Yep, that's what I was thinking too.
I'll go out there and see if I can find out what the problem is. You want to come with me?
Might be better if you went by yourself. Those boys might come closer to shooting straight with you if I ain't around.
Who's a ringleader?
Now, there's two of them. A couple of brothers I hired not long ago. Their names are Fowler, Mike and Gib Fowler.
I'll see what I can do.
I'm obliged, Frank. Things have been going pretty well. I don't need some new trouble.
None of us do.
The Lucky Lizard was the closest of the mines enough so that the noise from the mill could be heard in Buckskin most of the time. It didn't take long for Frank to ride out there. Tip Woodford served as his own superintendent, but he had several foremen who supervised most of the day-to-day operations. When Frank rode in, he spotted one of the men walking from the stamp mill toward one of the storage buildings.
I'm looking for the Fowler brothers. Got any idea where I can find them?
Mr. Woodford talked to you about the trouble out here, right?
That's right.
Well, Gib Fowler is down in the mine right now, but Mike is over in the barracks, I think. He came off shift just a little while ago.
You put them on different shifts?
Thought it would be best. The way those two run their mouths, if they were both on the same crew, no work would ever get done.
If they're causing trouble, why doesn't Tip just fire them?
I've asked him the same question, Marshal. He says that he can't fire somebody for having an opinion, that it just wouldn't be right. But if you ask me, he ought to boot both of them out of here.
You don't stand up to Woodford. He's just going to keep taking advantage of you. He ain't never going to treat you fair unless you make him do it.
Frank stepped into the doorway. He saw a wiry man with a bristling red brush of a beard standing in the center of the aisle between the bunks, waving his hands
just
in the air as he
talked. Just because Woodford's the boss don't mean he's got the right to treat us like animals!
Half a dozen miners were either stretched out or sitting on their bunks, listening to the man. Some of them noticed Frank's entrance and looked past the speaker at him. The man with the red beard noticed that and fell silent, turning toward the door with a suspicious glare on his face.
Are you Mike Fowler?
I can see who you are, mister. Woodford's called in the law to try and shut me up and keep me from telling the truth.
The only reason I'm here is because I heard reports that somebody's trying to stir up trouble out here at the Lucky Lizard.
The only one stirring up trouble around here is Woodford, because he don't pay fair wages.
How do you boys feel about that? You think Woodford's not treating you right?
Well, I always figured he's a pretty good boss, but then I found out that Mr. Monroe over at the Alhambra is paying 10 cents an hour more.
Yeah, and he's got his men working in 10-hour shifts instead of 12 hours at a time.
Mike says the shaft is shored up better over there, too.
Is that a fact? Were you the one who told him about the pay and the hours, too?
Somebody's got to tell the truth.
How is it that you know so much about the wages and the hours and the working conditions at the Alhambra?
You ain't gonna twist things around and make these men distrust me, Marshal. I've been honest with them from the first. They know that my brother and me used to work over there for Monroe.
If it's so much better at the Alhambra, why aren't you...
Because Monroe fired us, me and Gibb both. We got a mite liquored up one night and got in a fight with one of the foremen. Hammersmith actually fired us, ball-headed bastard. But Monroe backed him up on it. So you see, we ain't got no love for Hammersmith or Monroe, either one. And we damn sure got no reason to be telling folks that their mine is better than this one, except for one. It's the truth.
Are you saying that these fellas should go to work for the Alhambra?
Wouldn't do them any good if they tried. Hammersmith got a full crew over there. What I think they should do is get Woodford to pay them right and treat them better.
Has anybody talked to him about that?
We tried. He won't listen to reason. Just says that he can't afford to pay us any more than he already is. And he claims the mine is safe. All he'd do is promise to think about cutting back on the number of hours in a shift. But thinking about it ain't gonna get it done.
If you don't get what you want, what do you plan to do?
We'll do the only thing we can do to make Woodford listen to us. We'll call a strike. Ain't that right, boys?
Damn right we will.
I think you ought to try to talk to Woodford again. If you want, I'll say something to him.
Frank suddenly felt a faint vibration in the floor under his feet and knew it couldn't have come from anything good. Thunder sometimes sounded like that and shook the earth, but this wasn't thunder.
Oh my God! Cave in!
Frank whirled around and headed for the doorway at a run. Fowler and the other miners were right behind him. They burst out of the barracks building and turned toward the mine entrance, where a cloud of dust boiled out of the dark mouth of the shaft. They weren't the only ones who had heard the rumble and felt the earth shake. Anyone who had worked around mines for very long had experienced those sensations, and once experienced, they were never forgotten. Men came running out of the stamp mill and the office to stare toward the shaft with stricken looks on their faces. Someone began to ring an alarm bell. Frank ran toward the mine entrance. So did most of the other men.
Give! My brother's in there!
So were probably a dozen other men, maybe more. Although Frank was no expert on such things, it seemed to him that the cave-in must have occurred fairly close to the entrance for the dust to be coming out like that so soon after the collapse. Of course, there was no telling what might have happened deeper in the mine, but Frank's hope was that even if the shaft was blocked, the tunnels were all right. In that case, they would have at least a chance to get any trapped men out of there before they ran out of air. The choking dust kept men from reaching the entrance right away. They tried to penetrate it, but staggered back, coughing and hacking. Frank pulled a bandana from his pocket and tied it over his mouth and nose like a bandit, then started forward into the dust. He took off his wide-brimmed hat and waved it back and forth in front of his face, trying to clear the air a little as he pressed ahead. He heard some of the other men following him, but didn't look back. Blinded, eyes stinging from the dust, Frank knew he had reached the cave-in only when he ran into it. He barked his shins against something hard and stopped. Clapping his hat on, he reached out with his hands and felt a jumbled barrier of rock, dirt, and broken timbers.
Hello?
Anybody hear me?
No response came from the other side of the cave-in. Men crowded around Frank on this side.
We gotta get these rocks out of here and see how bad it is!
That made sense. Frank grasped a chunk of rock so big and heavy that he needed both hands to carry it. Turning, he stumbled under the weight and headed back toward the mouth of the shaft. The dust was beginning to thin a little, and now he could see that the cave-in was about 30 yards inside the shaft. As he emerged and dropped the rock to one side of the tunnel mouth, more men rushed past him carrying picks and shovels. A couple of men trundled wheelbarrows into the mine. The foreman Frank had spoken to earlier rushed up carrying a lantern.
What's it look like in there?
Couldn't tell. The dust was still too thick. Looks like it's clearing
out
now,
though. You can tell there's some air blowing out of the mine. That means the shaft isn't sealed off completely. There have to be some little openings somewhere, and the ventilation holes deeper in the mine are supplying air.
You're saying the men trapped down there will be able to breathe?
Yeah. Anybody who wasn't caught in a collapsed area and killed by fallen rock ought to be all right. We'll have them dug out before they can die of starvation.
What about water?
There are water barrels down in the tunnels. They can make it for a day or two.
Frank felt a sense of relief wash through him. Although they wouldn't know for sure until they cleared away the cave-in, it appeared that this accident could have been a lot worse than it was turning out to be. But that didn't mean there was no danger. Men could have been crushed when the roof of the shaft collapsed. Others could have been hurt badly enough to need medical attention as soon as possible. It was still imperative that they reach the trapped miners just as quickly as they could. Frank followed the foreman with the lantern into the shaft. All the lamps along the walls had been blown out by the gust of air caused by the collapse of the ceiling. Dust motes danced thickly in the yellow glow as the foreman approached the site of the cave-in. Frank could see the barrier now that he had only felt earlier. It was a tumbled mess formed mostly of rock. With the practiced swings of men who had been using picks for years, several of the miners chipped away at the barricade, loosening chunks of rock so that the other men could pick them up and carry them out or pile them in the wheelbarrows to be hauled out later. The foreman didn't have to issue orders. The miners were already doing what needed to be done.
This never would have happened if Woodford had listened to us. We told him this mine wasn't safe. Now my brother's trapped in there, or maybe dead already.
Damn it, that's not true. There's no reason for this shaft to collapse. Timbers were in fine shape, and the rock was stable.
Yeah, we can all see for ourselves just how safe it is.
Time didn't mean much underground like this. Frank had no idea how long they had been working at clearing the blocked area. He knew he wouldn't be much good with a pick, so he took over the job of using one of the wheelbarrows, rolling it toward the mouth of the shaft when it was full. His muscles strained against the weight of the rocks, and after several trips, he was drenched with sweat. At last, an excited shout went up, filling the tunnel, and Frank knew that meant the rescuers had broken through the barrier. Everyone crowded forward to see as the air moving through the shaft from inside the mine picked up. The irregular opening that had been created was a small one, no more than a foot square, but that was enough for Mike Fowler to put his face up to it.
Gib! Gib!
Mark,
can you hear me?
Is that you?
Yeah, it's me! Is everybody all right over there?
Most of us. A couple of men were caught when the ceiling come down, but the rest of us weren't hurt.
Now hang
on! Out of here?
We'll have you all out of there in no time!
Actually, it took another hour of hard, back-breaking labor before the hole was enlarged enough for Gib Fowler and the 9 other miners with him to crawl through to safety. They were taken out into the sunlight and open air, which they greeted with gratitude.